some ground state plus excitations with energy capital E sub k. And these gamma operators were the transformed operators from the original fermion operators that create excitations. And the ground state is defined by gamma k sigma acting on psi bcs is 0. So this does not give us an explicit way of writing that wave function, but it tells us what the operator acting on that ground state would give us. The explicit wave function I wrote down for you in terms of that anti-symmetrized pair state. And these capital EKs were CK square plus delta K square. And CK is the difference of the bare dispersion from the chemical potential. OK, so what I want to do is to dwell a little more on the particle hole mixing, which was at the heart of getting this transformed Hamiltonian. What does it really mean? We have done the whole algebra, but what does it really mean? So let me write a few other things, which was how these operators transformed. So gamma k up, gamma minus k down dagger was uk minus vk star. Okay, and we got these coefficients. These are the coefficients UK and VK were obtained by from two equations. This was coming from the unitary condition. And the other one was coming from requiring that terms which had gamma dagger, or gamma, gamma, those coefficients had to be 0. And that gave us another condition. This is requiring and by solving these, we got Vk square is half 1 minus Ck over Ek, and Uk square is half 1 plus Ck over Ek. Okay, we also have from here another relation which will be useful later, which is 2UKVK is delta K over VK. Okay, now we are ready to take a stab at what these really mean. So for that, for that, let us look at the spectral function. Okay, so what our aim is to understand this particle hole mixing. Now let me just remind you what we mean by this by the spectral function in the non-interacting Fermi system. So we'll do it in parallel. So here I have non-interacting Fermi gas. And on this side, I will do the BCS superconductor. And we look at both at zero temperature. So let's start here. We have A of k and omega. This can be thought of as minus 1 over, formally, it's the imaginary part of the Green's function. But since we are not talking about Green's function, I won't take you through that. But let me just write down formally, it is the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function. And you can think of it as the probability to find an electron at in the state k and omega. And you know if they are non-interacting, this is just delta omega minus epsilon k. So for a given, here is k, here is epsilon. This is the chemical potential. So for a given k, there is only, so if I pick a k, there is only one energy, epsilon k, which is given by whatever dispersion it might have. For example, h bar square k square over 2m, at which we can find the electron. And if I did an experiment, and these experiments are done all the time, in what is called, so ARPES, angle resolved photo emission spectroscopy. This is the ultimate experiment that tells you everything about the electron. If you knew this, you have basically stripped the electron of all its shells that it may have. Like if you measure density of states, you don't know about the momentum. If you measure something else, momentum distribution, you don't know what the energy distribution is. This one is all the information bare. And this is what it would look like. So I'm going to set 0 to be my chemical potential. So that's mu. And these are different cuts in k. So k equal to k1, k equal to k2, k equal to kf, and then marching on, k equal to something else, k3, and so on. So these are my points, sum 1, 2, here, and here. And what you will see at each cut is you'll see a delta function which disperses through the chemical potential and goes up like this, forming, if you map the positions of these delta functions, you essentially get the dispersion. So that's the story with non-interacting systems, non-interacting fermions. Now let's try to do the same thing here. So in this case, A of k and omega would again be minus 1 over pi imaginary part of the Green's function, turns out, is a 2x2 matrix. Again, I'm not going into that. But it's the 1-1 component of that 2x2 matrix of K and
omega. Sorry.
Yes?
Oh, could you explain GKR again?
No, I'm not going to go there. It's just the Green's function. So if you've heard about it before, that's good. But otherwise, take it to be the probability of finding an electron in that state.
Why is the imaginary part A?
That is the formal definition. So the Green's function will have poles, and the imaginary part of the pole will give you, so there will be a principal part, and then the imaginary part will pick up a delta function. So that's the structure. And in the BCS case, this quantity, AK of omega, will turn out to be UK square. So it's not just a delta function here. It has a weight, UK square, delta omega minus EK plus VK square, delta omega plus EK. And if you plot this UK and VK from those expressions, what you get is this. So here is VK square as a function of CK. Yes?
Shouldn't it be UK square?
Ah, yeah, UK square.
Excuse me?
Yes?
What does, I mean, under the Green function, what does the two line
mean? Don't worry about that. Just, it'll turn, you know, I'm not doing it in so much detail, but when you have BCS superconductivity, the Green's function turns out to have a 2x2 structure. So this is a 1-1 component of that. And just putting this up because in case in some next field theory course you see some of this, you'll be able to make a connection. But right now my focus is to explain what does this particle hole mixing really mean? What exactly is getting mixed? So if I look at VK square and just plot that function, you can see that CK is epsilon K minus mu. So if I look at, this is zero. If I look at energies less than the chemical potential, VK square will be 1 minus minus 1, because CK is negative on this side. And that will give me a behavior like this. So that's what VK square looks like. UK square, on the other hand, looks like this. So that's UK square. Okay? And you see that right from there. Because for EK was, I wrote it there, so we should write it again here. EK is CK square plus delta K square. So on a scale of order delta, this width here is on the scale of delta. Okay, so now what that means is if I try to do an experiment to extract an electron, previously I could extract it from a particular state K with probability 1. Now what will happen is, and we should remember here, UK square plus VK square is equal to 1. So the total probability is 1, but it is getting fractionated into two parts. And that's what it will look like is shown here. This is now A of K and omega. Here is omega. That's the chemical potential. Okay. So what you'll see at values of k well below kf, at values here, most of the weight is going to be in a vk square. So let me take two colors here. And a little bit in a uk square. And then as I march up in k, you will get something here, little less, and this one will start growing. And finally, at kf, or at the chemical potential, it will be exactly half-half. So now you have half the weight here and half the weight here. Half here and half here. And then again, it will start moving off with the blue one growing and the white one decreasing. Okay, so what it is trying to say is, if you try to extract an electron from a particular state k, these are for different values of k. If you try to extract an electron from a particular state k, so you're making a hole, but you're also putting some weight in the particle, in the what would have been unoccupied states. For the non-interacting problem, are indeed occupied to some extent. And that's what the spectral function will look like. And you can see that from here, that's telling you how these occupancies are going to go. Now, what is important about this mixing is that the order parameter, delta k, this is the order parameter. Is a product of uk times vk. So it is largest in the region right here. This is where delta k is largest. Okay, so what it is telling you is there is, of course, double occupancy of these states which are well below the Fermi surface. They have two electrons, up and a down. But that's not good enough to get pairing. Just a minute. The pairing happens near the chemical potential, where the fermions are able to go in and out of k states. Because of the attraction, they are able to mix. And it's because of this mixing, uk times vk, that you get an order parameter that becomes finite. Question?
Could you explain what you're plotting and what are all the axes?
Yeah, sorry. What I'm plotting is A of k and omega, this expression. So it, of course, has two delta functions. And the question is, what are the weights of these delta functions? The weights are given by those plots over there. And what I'm plotting here are cuts for different values of k. So let me draw that.
So a question, should we think of it as a delta function or some Gaussian?
Think of it as a delta function right now. Okay. I'll come to that question in a bit. So what I'm doing is this. I had a CK which is this. This is as a function of K. When I turn on superconductivity, it becomes Ek, which is Ck square plus delta. Let me just say delta. You can think of, delta K confuses you, you can just think of it as a constant. And what that does is your spectrum now becomes far away from the chemical potential. This is Kf. Far away from Kf, delta K is practically zero. And so here, we can write that down. So let's take a simple model. Let's think of a simple model in which Vkk prime is equal to minus V only in the shell. And it's zero otherwise, just like we did for the Cooper problem. And this will give you a gap structure delta k, which will be delta naught for k belonging to shell and zero otherwise. Okay, so what that has done is that in your spectrum now, you have this is Ek as a function of k, here is kf. What you have now is something like this, where it looks like, so if I take the mod value of this, it will look like, so this is mod Ck as a function of k. Now, what that delta k does is far away, Ek just looks like Ck. But near the Fermi energy, it has a gap. Because near the Fermi energy, this is going to zero. I can ignore that term. And Ek is just delta naught. So this point here is delta naught. OK? And what I'm plotting there is this behavior. So most of the weight is here, and then a little bit in this. And then on the other side, most of the weight is there. No, the blue increases on this side and decreases on the other side. But OK, I think that's better seen from the UK and VK plots. But that's what I'm drawing. I'm drawing the new dispersion that the quasi-particles have after the attraction. And so these plots here are at different values of k. So once again, I can label them with a 1, k1, k2, k3. And going forward, so this could be 0.1, 2. This is the point exactly at kf, and then a 0.3 going above. So let me label that here. This would be k equal to k1, k equal to k2, k equal to kf, and then k equal to k3. Okay? So that gives then a very complete picture of exactly what the dispersion is in the presence of this attraction.
In the second picture of the absolute value of epsilon, why the concavity has changed?
What has changed?
The concavity for k.
This is linear.
In the picture in the bottom.
Yeah, this should be linear. I really only care about the behavior nearby, which is linear. Okay? All this analysis is really important nearby. Okay, so that gives us then the spectral function, and now we can get quantities by integrating that. So now, from Ak of omega, we can sum over all k, let's say, and then we can get a quantity which is n of omega, the density of states. That's one quantity we can get. We can also get from Ak of omega by integrating over all from minus infinity to zero, the chemical potential d omega, we can get n of k. So there are two very important quantities we can get. This is called the momentum distribution function. And again, we have seen this before, both for non-interacting bosons and fermions and all that. So we have this result already, that for non-interacting fermions, n of k as a function of k at t equal to 0 is just a step function. And this is kf.
What does, I mean, why are we integrating just from just to zero?
Okay, this is because I want the momentum distribution function, which is telling us what are the occupied states. Okay, so I integrate up to the chemical potential to count only the occupied states. There's, of course, an overall sum rule also. Integral from minus infinity to infinity of a of k and omega d omega, that's just one. Right? So I have that overall sum rule. If I integrate only up to the chemical potential, I'm counting what are the states that are occupied. And for non-interacting fermions, it was this very nice step function at zero temperature. Now, when you do the same thing for these superconductors, you find that n of k will be vk squared. You can show that just from there. Or another way you can show that can also show from the definition, from n of k, which is ck dagger ck, right? I can put a sigma if you want. Let's say nk sigma. And these ck dagger cks can be converted into gammas, and I can evaluate the expectation value in the BCS state. So psi BCS, expectation value of this operator, psi BCS. You can do it that way also, and the answer will turn out to be the same. And it's an interesting exercise to do that. So what does that tell us? That tells us that the behavior in the presence of attraction is quite different. So the Fermi C, let me draw it on the same scale, the Fermi C has been destroyed. And the system, in fact, looks like this. So this is n of k, which is vk squared. Okay, per spin, I'm not worrying about that so much, but you can put a spin factor if you want. As a function of k, this is kf again. And it is broadened on the scale of delta naught, or rather square root of that. Okay, so this is for superconductor at T equal to zero. Okay, the Fermi surface is destroyed. The Fermi surface was defined as a very specific energy below which all states are occupied, above which all states are empty. That very sharp feature is gone. We discussed a little bit that if you had repulsive interactions between fermions, that step was reduced, but it did not vanish. And that's the definition of a Fermi liquid, that it must have a finite step. Now, in the case of a superconductor, what you're seeing is that even though the system is at zero temperature, the momentum distribution is broadened, not because of thermal broadening, but because of particle-hole mixing. So I should write here the broadening is not due to thermal incoherence, but due to particle hole mixing. In the coherent ground state. Yes.
You're saying this is like a Fermi liquid?
Pardon?
You're saying this is like a Fermi liquid? Are you saying that this is like a Fermi liquid?
No, I'm saying it is not like a Fermi liquid. So don't, I shouldn't confuse things here. All I wanted to say was that in a Fermi liquid, there will always be a step function there. So let me put that caveat, because you know this comes up in various discussions. So let me just put a little note here that in a Fermi liquid, N of k would look like this. This jump would be z. So finite jump persists. And that's a definition of a Fermi liquid. Now, in the case of the superconductor, there is no jump at all. It's completely broadened here, right? The Fermi surface is destroyed. There is no jump in NFK. Okay, and if we now do the other integral, which is sum over all k, what we get is, so let's evaluate this. N of omega, let me just do one of the integrals for positive ek, let's say, k greater than kf. Delta omega minus ek. And this can be converted into an integral using the density of states at the chemical potential times integral 0 to infinity dc delta omega minus ek. Now here, I want to get rid of all c's and write them in terms of capital E's. So I'll just do a little bit of algebra here. This dc can be written as delta C by delta E times DE. Question? No. And you can show from the form of EK that DC by DE will turn out to be E over C. And C is nothing but E over E square minus delta square. So when I do this whole integral now in terms of dE, I replace it by omega, what you get is N0 omega over omega square minus delta k square. Okay, and this comes out for omega greater than delta, and it's equal to 0 for omega less than delta. Okay, so if I now plot this, N of omega, let me put a little subscript for NS of omega for the superconductor over N0. Here's omega. What you see is here is delta. There are no states within delta. Above that, there are states, and there is this 1 over omega singularity. Sorry, 1 over square root singularity. Okay, so this goes like 1 over, this goes like omega over omega squared minus delta squared. And it's an integrable singularity. So the states that you have lost from here, these states appear in the region right here. So the number of states are conserved, but what has happened is that a gap has opened up in the spectrum, pushing spectral weight out of the gap region into a peak right above the gap. And that's the density of states of a superconductor. And I've divided that by the normal density of states, which is not changing on this very small energy range. So just to remind you, the density of states of a Fermi liquid is something like this. It has a square root of E behavior. And what we are talking about is at EF, we are talking about some structure like this. Like that. That is what we are talking about. Here is the normal density of states at EF on a very tiny energy scale of order delta. A gap opens up. It pushes the weight out of this into these piled up regions around it. Okay, so that concludes some part of our discussion today up to the density of states. Let's look at some experimental data. Yeah, question?
So is that the density of states of a Fermi liquid or of the superconductor? Because, I can see that we would have that hole if it's a Fermi liquid.
So the white one, this is the density of states of the Fermi liquid.
Okay.
And the red one is the density of states of the superconductor. So far away, it just looks like a normal metal. Okay? Far away from the Fermi surface, it just looks like a normal metal. On the scale of this distance is 2 delta. On an energy scale, 2 delta, I showed you here what was happening at positive frequencies. You can also look at negative frequencies, which is below the chemical potential. And that's why you have a 2 delta gap. And that's the width in omega between the peaks, the two peaks. Okay, so let's look at some experimental data where these quantities have been measured, because this goes to the core of the superconductor. What we have seen is that because of pairing, there is an order parameter, and that order parameter we had defined that order parameter to be CK dagger with the two opposite momenta and opposite spins, and that order parameter has turned out to be the gap, delta, which shows up as a spectral feature in a density of states. So, okay, so can I have the screen and we can look at some data now.
So what's N0 exactly, is it?
Oh, sorry, yeah, I'm glad you're asking these questions. So you see, this is the density of states. I had a little mistake here. This is the density of states as a function of energy. Okay, and for a dispersion which goes like h bar squared k squared over 2m, the density of states, n of e, is defined by delta epsilon minus epsilon k summed over all k with the 1 over omega. That's how you define the density of states. So you put that in here, and if you solve for this dispersion, you'll find density of states that goes like square root of E. Now, what is N0? If I look, you see close to the chemical potential on a scale delta, on a scale delta, energy scale delta, much, much less than EF, the density of states is constant. Right? It's this thing. It's not varying very much. And that is written as N of 0. 0 implies at EF. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
But in the integral, we're taking the integral over all the
psi k, so how can you assume that, you know, you're...
It's only this region. The rest of it is not different, right? It's only this region. I'm saying you have dug out a hole, and that weight will show up in the peaks. Okay, can I have the screen, please? Hello.
Just on the touch screen.
It's not working from here. Okay, so let's look at a few interesting things about these. How do I? Is it connected?
Yeah, it's working.
Yeah. To show you a quick some data about some of the things we talked yesterday. This is okay. This is the original data from Kamerling Owens's lab, showing that he was trying to cool many things, gold and so on. Gold has never gone superconducting, even today at the lowest temperatures. And people have gone down to like microkelvin temperatures. But gold does not go superconducting. And on the other hand, when he looked at mercury, this is that transition, the superconducting transition. And I'll blow that up here. That's shown over this. So this is around 4 Kelvin. And you can see it has gone to, the resistance was around 0.1 ohms for the most part, resistivity maybe. And then it has gone to like a factor of 5 lower in this region. So that was that first observation. Okay, I just wanted to show you something we will talk about maybe on Thursday. This is that YBCO, the high temperature superconducting material. This is quite different in many ways from a BCS superconductor. In fact, in all ways. So you might as well figure out all the things I'm telling you, and then I'll tell you that they are wrong in YBCO. But one thing is for sure that you do see this sharp transition at TC, and TC you can see now is around 100 Kelvin. This number has marched up to about 160 Kelvin in one of the other members of this family. Okay, so now we talked about the gradient of the phase in the case of the superfluid. The same thing happens here. A superconductor has an order parameter. That order parameter is complex, and the gradient of that phase is once again a velocity of superflow of these Cooper pairs. And that superflow generates a current, persistent current in a loop. And left to itself, that current would not decay over an extremely long time frame, the age of the universe and so on. You can make these estimates. So if there's no dissipation, no vortices being nucleated, the current will persist. And it's these persistent currents that are used to generate a magnetic field. And it makes one of the biggest magnets that people use these days. For example, at LHC, they are using really big magnets those are all made out of superconductors using this persistent current idea. So that gradient of phase is driving this persistent current, which generates this magnetic field.
A short question. Does the current dissipate close to the critical temperature?
Yes. So the persistent current strength is highest at low temperatures. It's proportional to rho s, the superfluid density we talked about. So rho s is highest at low temperature, zero temperature, and then it decreases, and at TC it dies. So the point is, you want to have these magnets having TC as high as possible, because if you had a room temperature superconductor, that would be ideal. You don't have to cool that superconductor to get the super flow. But otherwise, if you want to use any of these magnets as a superconductor, these superconducting magnets, you have to cool below TC. So just a very quick idea of some numbers here. The Earth's magnetic field, as you know, is about half a Gauss. Refrigerator magnets, the ones you stick things on, is about 10 Gauss. And electromagnets that are made by winding copper wires take you up to 10 Tesla. One Tesla is 10 to the 4 Gauss. But you need, because these are, these have dissipation. These are ordinary metals. You pass current through them. There is I square R heating. These become really hot, and you have to constantly cool them to keep the heat out of these magnets. And how much do you have to cool them? I did a little calculation. And you don't need to go through all that, but you can sort of take out your elementary, ENM, and you can start with some number of turns, make an electromagnet, about a 4 Tesla coil, find out how much power is dissipated, et cetera, and you find that the temperature will rise to about 10 to the 4 centigrades. And the melting temperature of copper is about 1,000 centigrade. So, you'll melt the whole thing because of the heating. Now, if you have a superconductor, there is, you can avoid all of this heating, and you can make magnets all the way up to 45 Tesla. So you can see what you have gained from here. And that's how big they are. So let me show you. This is a typical magnet. This is about a 7 Tesla magnet that is used for MRI, all these imaging experiments.
Excuse me. What's the purpose from making more powerful magnets on superconductors?
Yeah, so we will see what happens. The superconductor is retaining its superconductivity by generating these supercurrents, the Meissner effect. And the Meissner effect forces supercurrents to flow in the magnet to keep the external magnetic field out. But what happens is that the magnetic field is acting against it, trying to get in, and it gets into the superconductor in the form of vortices. So we will see that. And beyond about 45 Tesla, the vortices have entered the superconductor and completely destroyed it. So that's the reason you can't go above that. But if you had something like these high-temperature superconducting magnets, you could go much higher. So there are promises there. And this is what, right now, a 45 Tesla magnet looks like. It's huge. It's not your idea of a little magnet that you can use. It's really a huge facility. Okay, this I wanted to show you because this happened at OSU. One of the students made this very interesting experiment. So just take a look. It is a little car which is floating on top of the track. What you're seeing is a track which is a magnet. So this is a manifestation of the Meissner effect. The track is a magnet. This little car has pellets of YBCO, this high-temperature superconductor. It has little pellets, and we have cooled the pellets to go below TC. So this is in a superconducting state. Now, what happens is a superconductor is a perfect diamagnet. That's what a superconductor is. If you want to think of it in terms of its magnetic properties, the Meissner effect, which throws the magnetic field out, essentially makes a superconductor the best diamagnet you could get. So it repels the magnet below and floats above the magnetic track. Let me show that. In the next one, which is even nicer, so this is just the superconducting pellet. You see how it's riding on top? And then it gets hot because of all the friction, and it dies. So we made this for one of the demos at the local museum. But yeah, okay, so that's all the fun we had. Now let me go to a little bit more history. This is the Bardeen, these are the three gentlemen, Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer. And this is in their paper came out in 1957, and this was their celebrated paper, which says in the first paragraph, this is what a theory of superconductivity must explain, and they list the five things I had put on the board, and they say, we present here a theory which accounts for all of this, and in addition gives good agreement for, et cetera, from experiments with no parameters, or rather just one parameter fit. So that was this very powerful paper. Okay, now for some thermodynamics. We will see how to get this quantity very soon from the UKs and VKs that we have generated. So what is shown here is the specific heat as a function of temperature. Okay, these are experiments. So what is done here is the line shown here, the linear line, this is on, what's the system? This is on aluminum. And aluminum is a metal at finite at high temperatures. Below some temperature TC, which is about 1 Kelvin, it shows this big jump in the specific heat. And then the jump decreases. And finally, at very low temperatures, it has an exponential approach to zero temperatures. Okay, so this is the specific heat of aluminum. And it's contrasted with this linear curve here, which is obtained by applying a magnetic field on aluminum and driving it normal. So now you've destroyed superconductivity in that. And for the normal state, you can also get the specific heat. And as you know, in a Fermi liquid, the specific heat is linear in T. So this is that measurement. And so you have both the normal and the superconducting state specific heat here. Now you can really get the thermodynamic potential. Remember, our aim is to understand the superconducting ground state. The system reconstructs only because the superconducting ground state has a lower free energy compared to the normal ground state. And that information is sitting in this experimental data. How do we extract the thermodynamic potential? You can go to these relations. You know that the entropy is given by the specific heat divided by the temperature integrated over dT up to the temperature you want, right? That's the entropy. So you can take that specific heat curve and do this integral and get the entropy. And that's what it looks like. So here's the entropy in the normal state. It's linear in T. In the superconducting state, it drops below at TC and continues to drop as you go to low temperatures. That's telling you that the new ground state is more ordered. It has a lower entropy. And why is that? Because you have suppressed excitations. So in the Fermi liquid, when you try to excite it at any finite temperature, you can, around the Fermi surface, so here's the, can we have some lights? Okay, so this is the Fermi liquid, and this is the superconductor. So in the Fermi liquid, here, this is all filled up. At any finite temperature, I can excite electron hole pairs. In the superconductor, on the other hand, we have seen that there is a gap in the spectrum. So this, these states are filled up. This is a gap. That means there are no states here. And you have to excite across the gap. You have to excite across the gap. And as a result, the ground state in the superconductor is more protected because it's harder to dislodge it out of its state because of the cost and energy to excite these particle-hole pairs. And that gives you an idea of why a system would like to become superconducting, because it has a lower entropy. And if I now go on and get the free energy, which I can from the entropy. So you see how nice these thermodynamic relations are. When you're doing thermodynamics, you're just manipulating all these symbols, but you can see the meaning of that. In any experiment, you go with the specific heat. Once you get the specific heat, you integrate that and get the entropy. Once you get the entropy, you can integrate that to get the free energy. And then what you see is this. So here's the free energy. It's not a very nice plot. You can't see very clearly, but what you're seeing is this is the negative of the free energy that is plotted. Above some temperature, the two free energies are the same. That's Tc. Below that, the normal and superconducting free energies separate, and the one which is more negative is the superconducting free energy. So that's the reason the system wants to go into these ordered states. And Fermi liquids, we always want to see them become unstable, either into magnetically ordered states or into superconducting states. Okay. Just another quick flash to show you that this field has attracted many, many Nobel Prizes. And we talked about several of these people in this context. What I'm now going to turn to is, Kamerlingh Ohms, Landau for his pioneering work on helium, we didn't discuss so much, but also on Fermi liquid theory, BCS, of course. I will talk about Josephson effect. Giavar did the tunneling experiment to see that gap in the density of states. Many of these things you can view on YouTube. You can go to BCS at 50. There was a very big symposium held at Urbana-Champaign, and all these people, not all, but many of these people, including Giavar and Schrieffer and Cooper, have all talked in that symposium, so you can hear them. Bednoz and Mueller got the prize for high TC. These people got the prize for helium-3, and I will maybe talk a little bit about this in my colloquium tomorrow. Cornell, Ketterly, and Wyman for BEC in alkali atoms. And there were, of course, many other people associated with developments in superconductivity. And very soon today, at the end of the day, I will be moving into Ginzburg-Landau theory. Here is Ginzburg. And Abrikosov for his vortex lattice, and Tony Leggett also for helium-3. So that's the thing, okay. Mexican hat we will come to. Not yet, but okay. I try to do all this at one time because the logically I could have shown these at different times, but I don't like the interruption of these slides. So sometimes they don't come in the same logical order, but never mind. They are still interesting to see because it puts these things in context. So what I'm now going to come back to is the tunneling, this density of states, trying to see the gap directly. And the experiment that is done, this is not what Giavar did. He did a more basic version of this experiment, but this is how one does it today. So it's literally you bring a tip, a scanning tunneling tip, very close to the sample, and you're trying to push an electron from the tip into the sample. And the electron, of course, can only, it's going through a gap and a tunnel barrier. And through that, the electron is going to try to tunnel into the sample. Now, if the sample is an ordinary metal, okay, there are states available at the chemical potential. But if there is a gap, then you won't see any tunneling until you cross some threshold. So the experiment is done like this. You measure the current by applying a voltage across the sample and the tip. Okay, so that's the voltage across this sample and tip. And if there is just an ordinary metal, you get a linear relation, which is your V equals IR. But if there is a superconductor, then you can't push any current in until you have EV equal to delta. Okay? EV is an energy scale. Until the voltage becomes on the order of delta, there's no current. And if you now take the derivative of that, dI dV, you will see that that shows this behavior, the square root singularity. Okay, so let's just go to the data quickly. I don't need to go through this. Okay, here. So this is experimental data, believe it or not. It's so beautiful. It is taken on some ordinary BCS superconductor, niobium, and this is the dIdV, the derivative of that current voltage behavior, and you see the gap. You can read it off. It's on the order of 2 millivolts. 2 millivolts. And that's about 20 Kelvin, 15, 20 Kelvin. This is the gap in niobium. So the gap is half of that. It's about 10 Kelvin gap. And this is the very large, this is often called coherence peaks. These are very large pileups in the density of states. Okay, and from that, the peak-to-peak distance is 2 delta. You can extract EG, the gap scale, and look at it as a function of temperature. Okay, we will next just now do this calculation. This gap is temperature dependent. So I've been showing you this gap in the density of states around the Fermi surface. It depends on temperature. It gets weakened by the temperature, and it decreases and finally vanishes at TC. And you can see this is different materials and the BCS curve, and they fall really on top of each other. And luckily, we are in a position to calculate this curve from the formalism that I have developed. We are very close to doing that. Okay, I'll skip all that. So, you know, this is just showing a lot of materials fall on this. But, okay, that's, I'll come to the high TC part later. Okay, so that's as far as what I wanted to show you. What we can now do is see how much of this behavior we can calculate from the formalism we have developed. So can we take the screen back up? Hello? Can we take the screen back up? Okay. So we defined, we have defined the order parameter to be fk yesterday as c minus k down, ck up. And this is evaluated in psi BCS. And delta k was defined as sum over k prime, vk k prime, fk prime. Okay? So just like we gave some flesh to vk square and uk square, otherwise they would have just been some symbols, some coefficients for you, we are going to also do the same thing with the order parameter. We are going to really try to understand what is the structure and what it means. So, so once again, from here, we can replace CKs and CK, the CKs with gammas. And again, using the fact that this is the ground state, it can be shown to be just equal to UK star VK. OK, and I really encourage you to do those calculations yourself just by putting in these transformations. So with that, then this implies that this thing is shown using transformation. So then that implies that delta k is equal to minus sum over k prime, vk k prime, uk star, vk. And we had, conveniently, this board has come down. It's rather amazing. I needed exactly this board. And now we have this expression here, and that tells us 2uv is delta k over ek. So that is half sum over k prime, delta k prime over ek prime. This is the potential. So let me just write that part here. Delta k is I'm just rewriting it. This is called the gap equation. And you look at it and you say, what does it mean? What am I trying to solve for? You're trying to look at the number of places the quantity you want is sitting. You want to get this delta k, because that is the gap. And it is sitting here, it is sitting here, it is also sitting in ek. So this, of course, tells you you have to solve for this delta k self-consistently. Solve for delta k self-consistently.
Question? Did you assume that UK is real?
Okay, that's a good point. So all of these are, in general, complex. I can fix the phase of UK and make it real, but then VK can have a relative phase with respect to that. And delta K will have the same phase with respect to, so let me write that. UK can be chosen to be real. Okay? But, okay, then VK can have some structure, let's say VK e to the I theta. And delta K must have the same phase. Why? Because the right-hand side is real, right? So the only way for that is delta k must also be, this should also be e to the I theta, so that the thetas cancel here, and then the right-hand side, which is ck plus ek, is real.
Then in your graph equation, shouldn't you have absolute values?
So yeah, yeah. Where in my sum of the
gap equations, and those be
absolute. Oh, the gap equation. The gap equation, this is all complex, so this is okay.
Oh, yeah, you can reintroduce it.
Yeah. Okay.
A question, in which situation can we assume that both are real? Are there situations where, for certain potentials, as we saw in the tutorial yesterday?
Yes.
How can we detect?
Yes. So, typically, if you don't have a magnetic field,
okay. You
will see that UKs and VKs will be just real. And if you have a magnetic field, it will generate some kind of vorticity, and that will be picked up by a phase in VK.
Okay.
But that's a good question. Okay, so once again, just to solve this, we go to our simple model, which is defined on a shell. All the VKK prime structure is taken to be a constant. And then delta K prime is also a constant. What that means is that around the Fermi surface, there is a gap, but the gap is the same at all points in K space. That's what a constant delta naught means. There is no variation of the gap as you go along the Fermi surface. So if I just take again that simple model, which I'm not writing down again, then the equation you have to solve is 1 is equal to V naught. So then, actually, let me just write it down. VKK prime is equal to minus V naught for KK prime belonging to shell, zero otherwise. And similarly, delta K is equal to delta naught for K belonging to shell, and zero otherwise. Okay. We like this model because it's simple. And it brings out what it means to solve that problem self-consistently. Right? So I can do this. I can integrate it. So I get 1 over n0 v0 is then integral from 0 to h bar omega c. H bar omega c is the cutoff of the shell, dc over delta square plus c square, square root. So what I did here to get 1 is I canceled delta naught on both sides. And that is sine hyperbolic I should put a delta naught to be consistent. And you can solve this now for delta naught. This implies that delta naught is h bar omega c over sine hyperbolic and that is also approximately 2 h bar omega c e to the minus this is for weak coupling. Okay, so this is the gap equation solution, and it tells us that delta naught, the size of the gap that opens up, is of this form. And this should remind you of the Cooper calculation we did. It was the binding energy of the two electrons was given by an expression like this. There was a small factor. It's not a small factor. It's in the exponent. But there was a factor of 2, which was different here when we did the bound state calculation. But other than that, the structure is the same. It's an essential singularity and so on. The difference is now we have done this calculation for the many-body state, not just a two-particle problem. So this is the gap for the many-body state. Compare with Cooper. Okay. Yeah, question?
Yeah. What is omega c in this
problem? Oh, omega c was that shell cutoff. When we were doing the Cooper problem, I had defined it very carefully as a shell within which the attraction is operated and not outside it. So it's that cutoff in energy space. Okay, so that's the gap equation solution at zero temperature. Now let's look at it. So what this is telling us in terms of the experiment we just saw, in the tunneling experiment, the spectrum has a gap, and this is the delta naught that would be measured at zero temperature. How would it behave as a function of temperature? For that, we have to look at the same kind of equation, but at finite temperatures. So let's do that. And the way it's done is very similar, except we take expectation values in the thermal distribution. And this is now a mean field trace. So let me write that down. It means a trace do this a little bit more because just so we know how to play with these variables. Okay, so that's what these averages mean now. It's a thermal trace. So if I look at delta k, it will look like this. There will be a sum over k prime, vk k prime, delta k prime, just like what we had before. And then there would be these gamma terms. So there would be an average, 1 minus gamma k up. I just want to show you where the temperature will come into the theory. Up, up, minus gamma minus k prime down gamma minus k prime down. Okay, so I will get these excitations and the trace will basically be, tell me what is the number of excitations that I'm exciting at these momenta. Now, what we did gain by going, the electrons were strongly interacting, but these quasi-particles that we have got are weakly interacting. That's the whole point of going to a quasi-particle basis. So we are in this happy situation where gamma k up dagger gamma k up, this is like a number operator. And at finite temperatures, this is the Fermi distribution with energy Ek. So this is 1 over e to the power beta Ek plus 1. Okay. So the point here is that the quasi-particles, gamma and gamma daggers are weakly, or rather non-interacting fermions. And so they have a Fermi distribution function, which is a sharp step. The original fermions don't have a sharp distribution. They have that rounded distribution we calculated. But these gammas are like non-interacting objects because the interactions have been used up in constructing the new ground state. So now we have this right here, and we will get from these expectation values 1 minus 2 f of Ek. And if I put in that form, this will turn out to be a tang beta Ek over 2. Okay, so now we are home. The gap equation becomes delta K is equal to minus sum over K prime, Vk K prime, delta K prime, over 2a bk prime tang. My writing has slowly, there's a gravitational pull. Sorry, bk k prime, delta k prime, over 2e k prime. Times the tang function. This is the gap equation. Okay, once again, taking that shell model, we can solve this. And it's just a bunch of integrals we have to do. So it's I won't do that here. It's actually very involved. It's not that easy to do these integrals. But I think if you crank it out on Mathematica, it should be much easier. So what are we interested in? Keep in mind what we are after. We saw the experiment. It showed this tunneling data, right? this was n of omega versus omega divided by n zero. It goes to 1 at large distances, at large omega. That's 0, that's delta. From here, we can get this delta here as a function of temperature. And it has some shape like this. And what we would like to get is this value, delta at T equal to 0. We would like to get Tc, and we would like to get how it behaves here and how it behaves here. That basically defines the whole function for us, right? We don't care about details. But we must know what is the behavior of this gap at zero temperature, what sets the scale, what is Tc, because that's where the transition happens, and how do they vary near zero temperature and near Tc? That's what we are after. And all of this is contained in that finite temperature gap equation. Question?
Can you get the right critical exponents even though you're using them to zero?
So the question is, can we get the right exponent, right? The answer to that is yes. And it's only in this case, because what we have done is a mean field theory. We will come to that later. You will see that the exponent here, so you'll see that delta T will go like T minus Tc over Tc to some power, half. Okay? This half is a mean field exponent. And we will derive it just now. Yes. But it turns out for BCS superconductors, mean field theory is extremely good. It's actually the only system for which mean field theory is good. There's no other system you'll find in any magnet or any other situation where mean field theory works. But in this case, it does work to a very, very high precision. And it has to do with the fact that the coherence length was so large. So the fluctuations are down by some very large power of the coherence length. The so-called Ginzburg-Landau region, it is tiny. Okay, so let's look at this. So we want to determine Tc. We have already determined delta at T equal to 0. That was our calculation at the top where we solved the gap equation at 0 temperature. Now we want Tc, and you know that Tc can be obtained from here by noting that delta as T tends to Tc minus from below, delta of T is tending to 0. So I have to solve this equation. 1 over N0 V0 is equal to integral 0 to omega C dc tang C over 2TC divided by C. Okay, I have set T equal to TC in that above equation, set the gap going to 0 because by the time you reach TC, the gap has gone to very small, and I want to solve this integral equation. And you can do that, and what you find is TC is given by 2 e to the gamma over pi omega c e to the minus 1 over n0 v0. Okay, this is the Euler constant, which is around 0.5772. Okay, we don't really care about these things, but it's a number of order 1, but I just thought you can pull your analytical muscle and get all this. And this is 1 point about 1 omega c. If you want h bars, you can put them in. E to the minus 1 over n0 v0. Now, from the gap equation, we had 2 h bar omega c, all of that. So combining those two, this implies that 2 delta naught over Tc is 2 pi over e to the this Euler constant, which is about 3.53. This is the celebrated result that you get from BCS theory. What is the point? The point is that this is delta as a function of t. At zero temperature, this is the gap scale, delta at t equal to zero. This is Tc. Tc is given, the scale of the temperature, Tc, is exactly given by the scale of the gap. Okay? It sounds like, you know, I haven't made any very important statement here, but the statement, the meaning of this is that the gap is because of, you know, this particle hole pairing. As you increase Tc, you are breaking these pairs. And at Tc, you have broken all the pairing. So Tc is given by where the pairing has gone to zero. Oh, sorry, can't see that. Can you see that now? Okay. So 2 delta over Tc is about 3.5. So this is where BCS had their predictive capability. It's not like they were trying to calculate Tc. That would be a meaningless calculation to do, because for every material, Tc would vary. But what they said was, you guys go and measure Tc. And you guys go and do tunneling. Say you measure Tc in a resistance measurement. And you go and measure tunneling. And from the tunneling, you determine your delta of zero. And we predict, magically, that 2 deltas at t equal to zero divided by Tc is 3.5. And they did it, and I had that in my charts. Reams and reams of data on many different materials, it always came out around 3.5 with a little bit of variation. So that's what made it so very successful. Okay, so that's the story of the gaps, the gap equation, and the order parameter. One more thing, if I can just squeeze in, and then we will be ready to start Ginzburg-Landau theory. And that is, actually, maybe we can skip it. So I, maybe it's a good time, I can just take more questions. You have questions? Yes. So he's asking a question after my heart. Does this number hold for high temperature superconductors? Okay, and what you will see in high temperature superconductors is that this ratio actually can go to infinity. So it breaks down with a vengeance. Not only is it different, but it can become so different.
So could you make a relation between Tc and delta?
In high Tc? So this is a very important point. Let me bring it up right here. Maybe it's a good point to bring it up right now. Is Tc always related to delta t equal to zero, to the gap? For all superconductors.
Excuse me.
Yes?
For 5 minutes.
Okay. Dennis says 5 minutes. Okay. Because now you've got me started. This I could go on for a couple of hours at this point. Now it gets really exciting. But okay, 5 minutes is all he's giving me. This is now getting into very beautiful territory. Let us make a very interesting axis here. This axis on the horizontal scale is an attraction. Some kind of a coupling, G. Okay? So I'm going to start at weak attraction here. and make it really strong on this side. And what you'll see is when the attraction is weak, this is our regime where we have these Cooper pairs up and down, which are very large and overlapping, like we were talking about the other day. And on this side, they are very tightly bound. Okay, and I can ask, what does TC do as a function of G? And what does the gap do as a function of G? And what you'll see is, this should even be very exponentially suppressed. You know, we derived that non-analytic behavior. It's very, very exponentially suppressed. And this curve here is TC. Okay, so TC rises as I increase the attraction, going from a BCS regime of large overlapping pairs to a BEC regime of tightly bound pairs. OK, now it turns out that another scale is there in the problem, if you look at it. There's another scale T star. And that is, so here is TC, this is T star. And what is the point about T star? So what you see is, that TC on this side is associated with a gap, but as you come towards strong interactions and the BEC regime, this is really where the gap opens up. And this is really where you get long range phase coherence. Okay, so TC becomes proportional to the superfluid density. And here, TC was proportional to delta naught. Okay, so what I want to say is, we will discuss this a little bit more when we talk about this kind of crossover. But in a way, this puts everything in a very good framework, in a compact framework. The BCS regime is a regime that describes mean field theory with no phase fluctuations. So you see the destruction of the superconducting state when you break the pairs. When you go to strong attraction, the bosons have become so tightly paired, like helium, for example, that TC is now no longer given by breaking of pairs. That's a very large energy scale T star. Another mechanism kicks in at that point. And this order parameter has a phase, but the phases can fluctuate, like we talked about for helium 4, that vortex model. The phases can fluctuate, and it's the destruction of long-range phase coherence that can destroy the condensate. So a different mechanism kicks in. And you can see the whole thing really beautifully by just working on a model that has an attraction G that you can tune. So that VKK prime that we were talking about, we always confined it in a shell. That's a very big assumption, which is valid for weak coupling. Once the attraction becomes stronger and stronger, the entire Fermi surface is being destroyed. You can't just say things only at the surface will be affected. When you start doing that, you go into this regime with long-range phase fluctuations, and that kills the condensate.
When you say that the pairs are tightly bound, that's in K-space.
So that's in real space.
That's in real space. But how do you get longer phase coherence?
There are two aspects to pairing. One is the size of your bound state, and the other is the relationship of the phase from one bound state to the other bound state. So there is another vector you can draw on top of it, which is the phase of this and the phase of that, which is all lined up. That's the complex phase of the wave function. And that describes the long-range phase coherence. So you're not worrying about the pair structure. The pairs are bound up. Because the pairing is so strong, you're not affecting that because of temperature. But you are affecting the fluctuations of the phase. OK, so we'll talk more about it. Thanks.